For the whole of this podcast, we'll be investigating the fascinating history surrounding the gallery's early years, its guiding principles, and its sometimes troubled relationship to the ever-expanding city and populace of London. And I'm here with the art historian Brandon Taylor. And I think, first of all, Brandon, you're going to have to tell us why Pall Mall and why the first floor of a former private house?
Well, the fact is that by the beginning of the 19th century, Great Britain had no national gallery to stand alongside those of the continental nations. And it became a source of concern to many parliamentary reformers how to establish a fledgling national gallery that was genuinely open to all members and all classes of the public. So it came about that the collection of a very wealthy banker, John Julius Angerstein, became available in 1823 after his death, and conveniently was situated in Pall Mall, which was very close to the heart of London.
So we've got this collection and we've got a place for it, but what's the idea behind having a national collection? What's it hoped it's going to do for the public in general?
Well, you have a number of different motives. One is to promote the existence of a British school of artists, but in more general terms, it was thought that the experience of looking at fine paintings would enhance the lives and the experience of a broad mass of the public in England, increase their sense of design, improve their taste, and generally elevate their consciousness of what it was to be a member of the nation.
Now, the original 100 Pall Mall was demolished, wasn't it?
After a great deal of complicated negotiations throughout the 1820s, it was decided to develop a site in Trafalgar Square on the north side, which would, first of all, house the Royal Academy and the Public Record Office, as well as this collection of pictures from the Angerstein House.
But did the National Gallery really attract all ranks and degrees of men?
Well, not exactly all ranks of men, or indeed women. There was a cut-off point. There was a broad public access, as far as we know, but nevertheless, it was still a requirement that you had to be reasonably well-dressed, not bringing in mud and rainwater on your boots, and not a member of the very lowest orders and indeed the mob.
And we're now with the gallery archivist, Alan Crookham.
Thomas Ewan's keeper of the National Gallery from 1847 to 1855 was particularly concerned with large numbers of visitors coming in who perhaps he felt behaved inappropriately in the gallery space. He was worried about people coming in who were eating and drinking in the gallery, children who were coming into the gallery to run around, they could play in the gallery, they weren't being kept under control. And I think he was worried that people were coming into the gallery for other reasons than to actually look at the paintings on display and to sort of enjoy the gallery for the purpose for which it had been established.
So that this pivotal moment around the beginning of the 1850s, it seems that the public is learning how to be a public for art, and the gallery seems to also be learning how to be a gallery, or that there is a sort of general will to understand how to run a gallery.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's about setting it up on the most modern principles of the time. I think that the National Gallery here in London was actually quite open compared to many European collections, which could be a lot more closed.
And do you think that's remained the ethos of the National Gallery to this day?
Absolutely. I think the National Gallery is still accessible.
Thank you very much. And it's there that we come to the end of this podcast.